The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Bill Marimo, and I'm the editor of The Inquirer, and I'm here to introduce Dan Biddle and Murray Dubin. First and foremost, I want to say that this is truly a pleasure and a privilege to be introducing my two friends and longtime colleagues, Dan Biddle and Murray Dubin. Before I talk about their book, Tasting Freedom, I want to tell you a little bit about the two authors you'll be hearing from tonight. And these are facts that I don't think you'll find in the standard biography. This is the unexpurgated edition. First of all, I want to tell you what Murray and Dan have in common. They're wonderful journalists. They're meticulous, fastidious reporters. They're literary quality writers. They're native sons of our city and our suburbs. They're great colleagues. They're great friends. And now they are truly outstanding scholars and historians. First, let me talk about Murray. He's older. And he had a great corner jump shot in his heyday. He was born and raised in South Philadelphia. As he says, his corner was Fifth and Wolf. Murray's dad sold newspapers, along with miniature Liberty Bells, candy, and cigarettes, at the Greyhound Terminal at 17th and Market Streets. Murray graduated in class number 223 from Central High School and in 1969 from Temple, along with the that year's NIT champs led by Johnny Baum. Murray joined the Inquirer in the summer of 1971 after serving a stint as a cowboy in Wyoming, the only cowboy from Fifth and Wolf. And he worked at the Inquirer for 34 years as a really top-notch reporter, correspondent, and editor. Murray was an expert on subjects as disparate as the radical group MOVE and the Mummers. Murray first heard about Octavius Caddo in 1993 when he was researching a book on South Philadelphia at the Library Company of Philadelphia. Murray said, quote, "I was blown away by this guy's life," close quotes. He was amazed by Caddo's academic background, his mastery of Greek and Latin, what he did to desegregate Philadelphia streetcars in the 1860s and 1870s, and the fact that he was a jock. Now let's turn to Dan Biddle, or as his mom calls him, Danny. Dan Biddle's first home was on Graver's Lane on the border of Roxborough and Chestnut Hill. As a child, his family moved to Bala Cynwyd. Dan graduated from Friends Central in 1971, from Michigan in 1976. Dan's dad was a professor of English at Widener, at Drexel, and at Rutgers. His mom, who is here in the front row, taught English at St. Peter's School in Philadelphia, and according to sources, was a, quote, great mom. Dan began working at the Inquirer in 1979, where I first encountered him as a reporter in the Inquirer's City Hall Bureau. The only assignment that I ever gave him during the time we worked together was to bring in a television to watch the 1980 National League playoffs, Phillies versus Houston. And he performed extremely well and did it on time. In 1987, Dan was part of a three-person group at the Inquirer, including Rick Tulsky and Buzz Bissinger, who won a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting for their work in disclosing corruption in the Philadelphia court system. Dan first heard about Octavius Caddo driving on the Schuylkill Expressway. He heard a radio interview with a Haverford College professor named Roger Lane. Dan said, quote, I thought the guy's life would be a great story. Turns out he was right, and that day on the expressway was a real epiphany. So now you've heard about the two authors. I also want to say a word about their book, which I read in galleys about 6 months ago. It is, in my opinion, a truly great history of our city in the 1860s and 1870s, and the tragic and the largely untold struggle for civil rights in the years immediately following the Civil War. I don't want any of you to be daunted by the size of the book or its weight, 2 pounds, 2 ounces. It's really, truly wonderful reading, and it tells the story of the nobility, the determination, the courage, and the truly extraordinary character of Octavius Caddo. If you do nothing else tonight, buy this book. Dan and Murray, come on out.
You can keep clapping, it's okay. Thank you very much. Bill, thank you for that gracious introduction. The one thing that Bill didn't do is he sort of didn't distinguish who was who, so please understand, this is Dan.
The young one.
I'm Murray. We spent a lot of time together the past 7 years. There are people now who even think we look alike, which isn't true, but I'm the shorter one. I'd like to thank the library for inviting us, Temple Press, our publisher, for setting this up, and Bill, this is a very kind introduction. Dan has cautioned me not to speak too much, so I'm going to read. The book is set in the 19th century and spans the first three quarters of the century. Our preface, which is just one page, for some reason takes place in 1871, so it's really at the back end of the book. But I'm going to read the one-page preface. If I could find my glasses. It's called October 10th, 1871. The young white man had the number 27 tattooed on his hand and a bandage around his head when he began shooting at a colored man named John Fawcett. He missed. Fawcett, a hod carrier from the Philadelphia neighborhood of Frankfort, ran up South Street to escape. Joined by a crowd, the bandaged man chased him. Fawcett saw a cellar door in the front of a store in the middle of the block. Before he could dive in, a white boy stuck out a foot and tripped him. Fawcett scrambled to his feet, and the bandaged man fired again. That same afternoon, about a mile away, another Negro, a schoolteacher with the Roman-sounding name of Octavius Valentine Caddo, left a pawn shop on 3rd Street and began walking home. People on the street knew who he was, an orator who had shared stages with Frederick Douglass, a second baseman on the city's best black baseball team, a teacher at a black school of national renown, and an activist who had fought in the state capitol and on the streets for equal rights. He was 32. It was election day 1871 in the busy South Street area, the institutional and emotional heart of the black community had been rocked by violence since the night before. Was it the squire's doing? White policemen and Democrats who answered to him were attacking black voters, and scores had gone to the hospital. Caddo had sent his pupils home, sent them home early. Rather than going directly to his boarding house, he chose a safer route up Lombard to 9th Street, near his fiancée's home, and then down to South Street. He lived at 814. Caddo walked with an assured athletic gait, as if his right to the pavement were guaranteed, which it was, but only lately. Memories of slavery haunted every colored home. Generations of men and women had risked their lives to claim the simplest of rights, to learn in a schoolhouse, serve in the army, ride the railways, cast a ballot. Now those rights were being tested. Caddo turned onto South Street at the moment when, in W.E.B. Du Bois's words, Americans of color were first tasting freedom. As Caddo walked east, the bandage man was looking for more Negroes to hurt, more Negroes who would not be able to vote that day. He passed Caddo nonchalantly, but once he was five steps beyond, the bandage man turned and crouched. A young girl at 822 South Street shouted to Caddo, "Look out for that man." The bandage man was pulling out his gun.
That man in the middle of that scene, Octavius Caddo, the man on our cover, challenged Big League Baseball's color line 80 years before Jackie Robinson, led a campaign of civil disobedience to integrate the horse-drawn streetcars 90 years before Rosa Parks, marched with Frederick Douglass and 1,000 other men and women through the streets of this city in defiance of white mobs in the name of voting rights 100 years before Selma and Birmingham. And yet, with the exception of a handful of descendants and scholars, most Americans living today have never heard of him or of those men and women and their struggles in that early civil rights movement. And with this book, Murray and I intend to change that. And now people ask us all the time, you know, they look at us and they say, how do you guys happen to come around to write this book? And since this is the United States where none of us speak honestly and candidly about our racial feelings, we know that what they actually mean is not that at all. What they mean is, how is it that two white guys, you know, one in late middle age and one very, very old, decide to write a book about a black guy who died 100 years ago and whom no one's ever heard of? Well, Bill Marimo got it right in that gorgeous introduction. We are both old newspaper reporters by trade, and when you're a reporter, of course, the thing that you live for and breathe for is a good story. And it's even better if you figure out in the early going of figuring out that story that it's a story that not too many people know. And better still, best of all, if you discern early on that it's a story that can make a difference. As Bill explained, Murray and I stumbled onto the story of Octavius Caddo. And all those things struck both of us right away. Here's a guy whose life all by itself is going to be a pretty damn good story. And we sort of thought of him in the singular at first, that this was one guy who had had an extraordinary life. My goodness, he had been in all those equal rights campaigns. In addition to that, he found time to lead the entire boys section of probably the best black school in all of the United States in the 1860s. He led a baseball team. He led a drive to integrate the literary societies. In his spare time, he found a way to integrate the Franklin Institute, which had been segregated up until then. But we didn't realize in the early goings that this guy's life could not be told in a singular. We started goofing around online with the name Octavius Caddo. That's right, I goofed around online. At the end of my workday at the Enquirer, when I was just learning things like Google, and I took to putting Caddo's name into Google every which way, misspelled, spelled correctly, last name first, first name last. And one night in about the year 2002, I stumbled onto a genealogy website in which a man named Leonard Smith, who administered part of a hospital in Alexandria, Virginia, had posted a note asking for information about Caddo and about Caddo's father, William Caddo, and noting in his note that he, Leonard, was a descendant of William Caddo. Well, I got excited and sent Leonard Smith an email asking if he'd be willing to share his phone number with me, and within a night or two, we were on the phone for the first time. And that was one of the most exciting telephone calls of my life. Because Leonard told me that he was very intrigued to hear what Murray and I were up to. And he, too, had been intrigued by the story of his great-great-uncle, Octavius Caddo. And I'll never forget this. He said, "I'll help you guys any way I can with finding out more about Caddo. All I ask is that you have Denzel play him in the movie." Now, Leonard said one other thing to us that at first we took to be modesty. He said we needed to remember that there were really 100 O.V. Caddos. And again, I took that to be the modesty of a descendant talking about an ancestor. But with all the research Murray and I did, with each month and week of it, we realized the truth of what Leonard had said. You can't understand this man's life, Caddo, in the singular. He stands for a whole movement that's little known these days. And let's just do a quick quiz here, right? I'll bet most of the people in this audience went at least to high school, maybe to college. Show of hands. College graduates, keep your hands up. All right, you can put your hands down. Now, how many people know who Henry Highland Garnett was? Raise your hand. And how many people know who Fanny Jackson Coppin was? Raise a hand. Now, that is a crime. Garnett was the equal of Frederick Douglass. He was a militant black organizer, abolitionist, anti-slavery speaker who probably spoke to 1,000 audiences in North America between 1840 and 1880. He was the first black man to address Congress in 1865. He was a minister who rarely let people in on the fact that he got around on one leg. He not only got around on one leg, the fact that he was on this wooden leg did not stop the conductors and the drivers on a railroad train to Niagara, where he was headed to head over to Canada and give a speech one night in the 1840s, from asking Garnett to abandon his seat in the whites-only train car that he was on. Garnett, being a militant SOB, did not give up that seat. And so the conductor and a few toughs that he brought along picked up this one-legged man bodily and threw him off a moving train, nearly killed him. But Garnett had the presence of mind to turn that moment into testimony for that early civil rights movement. Now, we thought when we came across that story, all right, there's one guy who did what Rosa Parks had done 100 years later, and we wrote that down. And then we came across another and another and another, and finally we stopped keeping a list because it was clear from our research that men and women of color had done the Rosa Parks thing, the exact same thing, in streetcars and steamships and railway cars going all the way back to 1838. There was an episode that Frederick Douglass survived on a train in Massachusetts where railroad men tried to pull him out of his seat, and Douglass, being a big, strong man who'd already been beaten and whipped and had his bones broken in slavery, figured, if I'm going, part of this train is going with me. And he pulled two of the wooden train seats out of the train with him when these men threw him off. I mean, these were brave men and women. So the truth of what Leonard had to say really grew on us and grew on us, and we are delighted and excited to have with us tonight Leonard Garnett Smith. And Leonard, without you, we could not have done this book, and I would ask you to stand up.
Dan and Murray, you know I have to leave early, I have to get back to the university, but I wanted to make a special trip down here to thank you for this book, and on behalf of my family. And it's just a wonderful book, not only about my family, not only about a man, but it's really about America, it's about democracy, it's about freedom, it's about everything we're fighting for even today. And I think it's very, you put this book not on, you framed this book in terms of the struggle that's going on right now in this country. And I think it's a very, very important and timely book. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you. Well, let's just go to where the story of Octavius Caddo begins, and that's in the city of Charleston, South Carolina, back in the at the very beginning of the 19th century. Seven years and we still don't have our act together.
This book has 17 chapters, and 16 of them are set in the North. The first chapter is set in the South. And this is these are the first three paragraphs. It's a very short reading from Charleston and introduces Caddo's grandmother. On November 24, 1800, as Thomas Jefferson rode from Monticello in an open four-wheeled phaeton to conclude his campaign for president, Octavius Caddo's grandmother was being dragooned into slavery in South Carolina. This indignity gave poor Fanny Shields the distinction of having been enslaved twice. So says a document two centuries old. Her owner had freed her, but he was dead by 1800. And another slaveholder seized Fanny and her daughter with force and arms to use them as his slaves. It was a peril well known to the mulattoes, mechanics, Indians, dockhands, and former slaves who made up the city of Charleston's free colored population. Free was how the tax code defined their world. But somewhere on the high fence of caveats and contradictions around that world, this much was clear. You could be bullied into bondage at almost any time. Reclaiming your freedom, flimsy as it was, depended on having a white guardian vouch for you. He could do so by filing a claim of ravishment of ward. Those words are scrawled on the document. There were cords, the freedom of Fanny Shields, and the moment of her re-enslavement. I bet you want to talk some.
I do. One of the great big ironies that really moved us in this research was that Octavius Caddo gets born there in Charleston in 1839 at a time when black literacy, reading and writing, is not only frowned upon, which it had been there for decades, it's actually been criminalized. In 1835, if you can imagine this, I mean, I know we live in a state with a legislator that is not a Hall of Einsteins, but in 1835, the South Carolina legislature, reacting in large part to Nat Turner and that violence, passed a law that made it a crime to teach a person of color, slave or free, to read and write. If you were white and you broke that law, you could pay a fine, and if you were black and broke that law, you would be whipped. In that world, William Caddo, Octavius's father, finds a way by hook and crook to get this kid, his favorite child, a great education. They find their way north. You're going to have to buy the book to hear all the twists and turns of how they get up there. But by 1848, William Caddo, who had been a candidate for a Presbyterian ministry and a job overseas, if you can believe this, as a missionary in Africa, preaching Christianity to black Africans on behalf of the white slaveholding Presbyterian Church in the United States, William Caddo has turned that scheme on its head by 1848, and by the end of that year, he's here in this city on the same stage with Frederick Douglass and Henry Highland Garnett and some of the other great leaders of that early civil rights movement. And in Philadelphia, you know, by that time, little Octavius is a boy of nine. And it's not as if schooling for black kids in Philadelphia in 1848 was that much better than in South Carolina, but at least it was legal. And we tried to give people a sense of what this city was like if you were that free black family who made it here in 1848. It was no paradise. A colored man in Philadelphia could neither cast a ballot nor work in most trades, nor could he buy a railway ticket or celebrate the 4th of July on Independence Square. Even walking to the square, as Robert Purvis's tearful mother-in-law had told a visitor, usually resulted in, quote, a company of degraded creatures running after us in the street and calling out, nigger, nigger. But certain doors were open to William Caddo for the first time. He could teach his children to read and write and do simple arithmetic. And he placed Octavius in a grammar school for Negroes, a short walk down Lombard Street from his church. This meant the preacher could get his boy to the little school before work with the morning sun in their faces as they walked east on Lombard towards the Delaware docks. He could write an anti-slavery letter or read his own name in an anti-slavery newspaper, Frederick Douglass's paper, The North Star. Two inner engines now propelled William Caddo. One was a restlessness that sent him from one city to another, one pulpit to another, an inner agitation that made him useful to the cause of abolition and equal rights, not a general such as Douglas or Garnett, more like an officer on horseback running up and down the lines, contributing his something, as he had once said, in constant motion. Within his first few years in the North, Caddo joined in the drafting of fire-breathing broadsides against slavery, against the so-called colonization movement, a plan by slaveholders largely to send free people of color back to Africa, against any church, such as his own former Charleston church, that lent comfort to slaveholders. Caddo offered the movement a Philadelphia meeting place, his own pulpit, his own church, when other preachers would not. He drafted an appeal to white New Jersey citizens to sign petitions for black men's voting rights. Quote, we are indeed men like unto yourselves. He admonished one audience that the most vivid writings on slavery's evils, quote, fell far short of the realities his own eyes had witnessed, unquote, in South Carolina. He advised another that the Colonization Society was a Trojan horse, a ruse to exile free, opinionated Negroes like himself. Quote, a large, increasing, and improving free population that slaveholders may hold our brethren the more quietly and safely in chains. He exhorted other black ministers to steer the brightest children to Oberlin and the few other colleges that opened their doors to all races. And therein was heard the roar of his other inner engine. It was so powerful as to be his personal law of physics. Every act of the authorities of South Carolina and the United States of America to bar him and his people from the subversive acts of reading and writing, teaching and learning, would cause in William Caddo an equal and opposite reaction in the upbringing of his son. Octavius would attend the best schools available to a Negro boy, and since such schooling was limited at best, his father would track down tutors, petition school committees, and inveigle white men of influence to let his son join their academies. The same persuasive powers that had won him an endorsement and a geography book from the Presbyterian divines of Charleston would, from this day forward, be applied on behalf of his son. A caring father, then. But that is not a complete picture. There is no evidence William Caddo went to such lengths for any of his other children. It was more as though he were a gambler who looked around the family table and made a cold calculation. Being Negro boys in schools, boys and girls, in 1848, his children were fated to be waiters or drivers or domestics and to go to their graves, as the great black abolitionist Charles Remond had said, unwept by other Americans, uncared for, unprayed for. So Caddo placed his entire bet on his most promising child, the one most persuasive, the one most well-spoken, most curious, and most unafraid, the one most like himself.
Is it my turn?
It is.
It's very exciting. I'm going to jump up to 1862. Everyone knows about the Emancipation Proclamation, but there's really a wonderful backstory to the Emancipation Proclamation that Dan and I didn't know.
In 1862, Abraham Lincoln is not the iconic, everyone loves him president. The war is going badly. And if you're a black man or a black woman, this war isn't being fought to free you. It's being fought to keep the Union together. So no one's very happy with Abraham Lincoln. In September of 1862, in a handwritten page and a quarter or so, Abraham Lincoln writes the Emancipation Proclamation, which basically says in 100 days, if the South doesn't stop fighting, if this war isn't over, we're going to free the slaves. And everyone is stunned by this. And I'm going to read what happens, because not everyone believes he's telling the truth and that it's going to happen. 100 days from when he announced in September is literally New Year's Eve, December 31st. And blacks around the country watch and wait to see if this is really going to be and if the slaves are going to be free. Watch night was December 31st, and America never before had seen such a moment. Negroes, free and slave, waiting for the president to sign a document that would end slavery in the secessionist South. Emancipation Eve and the collective breath of a nation was held. It was of no matter that the president's motive was to hurt the Confederacy, not benefit the slave. Would he sign? Would pro-slavery pressure be too strong? In Philadelphia, black churches seemed to stretch their walls to make room for the crowds that just kept coming. Quote, they sang and shouted and wept and prayed, the white abolitionist B. Rush Plumley wrote to Lincoln. God knows I cried with them. At St. Thomas Church, which was near Walnut Street, one worshiper asked whether the president would colonize freed Negroes. Quote, God won't let him, someone shouted. In snowbound Boston, Frederick Douglass and Longfellow and Emerson and John Rock and Anna Dickinson waited and shivered with 3,000 more for the telegram that would signal Lincoln's signature. They worried that Mary Lincoln, a Southerner, would influence her husband in the way that wives do. Every moment of waiting chilled our hopes and strengthened our fears, Douglass said. At a military encampment near Fredericksburg, Virginia, George Stevens of Philadelphia waited as well. He was, on this December 31st, a valet and cook to the officer of the 26th Pennsylvania Regiment, Sickles Division, and a correspondent for the Weekly Anglo-African, a newspaper Negro workers for the military read and reread until its folds were worn. Stevens called Emancipation Eve a night of atonement for the errors and misdeeds of the past year, as they are tearfully and prayerfully remembered, and a new leaf is turned over. He wondered whether nations have to suffer for misdeeds as well as individuals, and he hoped that this may be the watch night which shall usher in the new era of freedom. Lost in the joy was the fact that no one was actually freed at the stroke of Lincoln's pen. 3 million slaves in secessionist states would be slaves no more, but only after the war ended. 500,000 more in border states that stayed with the Union, Delaware, Kentucky, Maryland, and Missouri, were not freed. Nor were slaves in parts of Virginia and Louisiana occupied by Union troops. But the declaration was wondrous. The government was, for the first time, announcing its intent to free the slaves. Lincoln, the orator whose words belonged to the ages, stood at the White House window and bowed in silence to cheering crowds. In Boston, the crowd cried, cheered, and sang. It did not stop for hours. In New York, Reverend Henry Highland Garnett knelt inside Shiloh Church and prayed silently from 11:55 p.m. to midnight. Then the choir sang, "Blow ye trumpets, blow, the year of Jubilee has come." The next day, Garnett called the proclamation one of the greatest acts in all history and led 3 cheers for the president and for our native land. At Port Royal, Charlotte Fortin was a young black woman. Freedmen, white soldiers, freed slaves who had become soldiers, and their white officers, including Thomas Wentworth Higginson, commander of the first South Carolina Volunteers, gathered on Emancipation Day. Fortin described an eager, wondering crowd of the freed people in their holiday attire with the gayest of head handkerchiefs, the whitest of aprons, and the happiest of faces. She saw troops parading in red pantaloons, a fine, soldiery-looking set of men. Their brilliant dress against the trees invested them with a semi-barbaric splendor. To us, it seemed strange as a miracle, this black regiment doing itself honor in the sight of the officers of other regiments, many of whom doubtless came to scoff. The men afterwards had a great feast, 10 oxen having been roasted whole for their special benefit. That same day, from Colonel Higginson's diary. Prayer by our chaplain, proclamation read, there followed an incident so simple, so touching, so utterly unexpected. Just as I took and waved the flag, which now for the first time meant anything to these poor people, there suddenly arose, close beside the platform, a strong but rather cracked and elderly male voice, into which two women's voices immediately blended, singing as if by an impulse that can no more be quenched than the morning note of the song sparrow, the hymn, My Country, 'Tis of Thee, Sweet Land of Liberty. People looked at each other, and then at the stage to see whence came this interruption. Irrepressibly, the quavering voices sang on, verse after verse. Others around them joined. Some on the platform sung, but I motioned them to silence. I never saw anything so electric. It made all the other words cheap. It seemed the choked voice of a race, at last unloosed. Nothing could be more wonderfully unconscious. Art could not have dreamed of a tribute to the Day of Jubilee that should be so affecting. History will not believe it. And when I came to speak of it, after it was silent, tears were everywhere. Your turn.
Well, what's our time limit? We're supposed to really stop at 8:15?
Yeah. I mean, we could.
We have oodles more readings that we would love to read to you, but I'm afraid you're just going to have to buy the book.
Yes. We would love to get your questions and answers.
You can buy two. They're excellent for weight training, £2 each.
If you have questions that have a sort of a congratulatory nature or praise, please direct them at me. If you have questions that are difficult and seek historic answers or question, please direct them toward Dan.
The younger guy.
I'm not doing this to be selfish, but Dan has a blushing problem. We don't want him to blush. So there are some microphones at each corner. If you raise your hand, I'll bet these people will come to you with a microphone, and it's important that you ask questions. Otherwise, we're going to be standing here. Someone, questions. Please raise your hand. Yes, ma'am.
I grew up in South Philly, and we always
Me
called
too.
It O.V. Cato.
Well,
it's a great question.
Yeah, we were not sure, and we found out the truth because we asked the descendant, Leonard, and he gave us the correct pronunciation. We also met another descendant, Leonard's uncle, whose name is Edgar Cato Montgomery, currently lives in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and he said as a little boy his mother told him it was pronounced cat-toe.
And other kids tried to say Cato. He should correct them by saying it's like a cat's toe.
But you're absolutely right. We weren't sure how to pronounce it until Leonard made us smarter. Someone else. More on this side.
I want to thank you for writing the book, and we will buy it.
It's but a I question mean- for me, right? Thank you, question.
But I'm interested yes. in the process. When two people collaborate, just how do you do it?
I was afraid someone would ask this.
Elbows. You go first.
How do we do it? Well, it really helped that we had both been newspaper reporters for a long time, and that's work that is just so collaborative by nature that, you know, most reporters sooner or later wind up working on a story with another reporter, and not all of them work well that way, but I think Murray and I had both done that. So we had a pretty good idea that one of us could write a draft of a chapter and the other one edit it and vice versa. And over the course of time, we sort of split up the chapters 50-50, where Murray wrote maybe 7 or 8 of them and I wrote 7 or 8. And then we'd go in and edit each other and make suggestions. And then in the larger sense,
Go ahead.
I mean, I'm about the slowest writer on earth, and Murray's a lot faster. So that was kind of a good yin and yang, because I'd write slow and come up with all kind of wonderful, you know, metaphors and facts and whatnot. And Murray would try to speed the plow and say, look, you know, it's already been 5 years. Let's get this going. But, you know, as long as you ask, I just want to say right now a big thank you to Murray Dubin for putting up with me. It's a lot of fun.
Collaborating is both wonderful and sometimes awful. And with Dan, it was mostly wonderful. We became immersed and obsessed by really little stupid things. And both of our wives can only take so much. So we had each other. And it turned out that while we both have some skills at this sort of stuff, we found out that the skills were a little complementary. For instance, Dan writes long. I write short. So if Dan would write a chapter that should be 25 pages, he'd write 32, and I'd write 18. So Dan knew he had to make me longer, and I knew I had to make him shorter. And it got to be a game. And there are many people who were concerned that the book would have more than one voice. But I actually don't think either of us has much of a voice. So it worked out.
Is Avery Rome here tonight?
She's not.
That's too bad. We never would have finished this book without a great editor at the Enquirer, Avery Rome, who was kind of our unofficial
advisor, cheerleader,
and whatnot from the beginning, and who, after reading a couple of our chapters, said to us, you know, this book is going to change people's understanding of America's racial history. And I thought that was just her being a good cheerleader editor, because I'm an editor and I like to egg people on too, but I've actually come to believe that she's right, and we owe her a great debt of thanks.
Yes, we do.
And also to our great editor, Temple Press.
Micah Clyte. There's a gentleman right there in the middle with a hat on. Do you have a question? You still have a question? You sure? Okay. Here's a microphone.
Do you know where is Octavius Cato buried at?
Yes. Would you like to know?
Yes, I would.
He's buried currently at Eden Cemetery, which is in Delaware County. There's a plaque.
We were actually there today.
He wasn't buried there originally. He was originally buried at a cemetery in South Philly that's no longer a cemetery, called Mount Lebanon. It's sort of between 19th and 20th Snyder and Peshunk. And then in the early 1900s, 1903, 1904, that cemetery, all the bodies were dug up and housing was built. And many of those bodies went to either Marion or to Eden, and Cato went to Eden. Yes, sir.
Good evening. Thank you very much for your presentation. As you researched for this book, did your opinion of Abraham Lincoln change from the time you started your research to the way you feel today?
Wow. That's a good
question. Yeah, that's a good one.
You answer that one.
I'm an American history major in college, and I think my view of just about everyone in that period was changed by this. With Lincoln, I had never realized what a shill as you probably know, he came by his equal rights side late. He was not that way at the outset. There's a moment that we're crazy about in the book where Lincoln, you know, Lincoln, whom we all associate with emancipation, and rightly so, who took, you know, as brave a stance as an American president has ever taken in the name of equal rights. Only a year or two before, he gathers Frederick Douglass and the other known black leaders in America in the White House and tries for half an hour or so to talk them into the colonization movement. Don't you want to move back to Africa? Can't I give you federal ships to take you to an island in the Caribbean or to Panama, where we believe there's coal to be mined in the isthmus that they used to call Cherokee in that time? And he tries to sell this line. And he urges these black leaders that if only they will get on board with that effort, then less educated black people will follow them. And this room full of the most accomplished black men in America study their shoes and tell them that they'll get back to them. By the same token, you know, you read back the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and Lincoln, I almost understood him better for what he was not. In the first debate where he takes on Stephen Douglas, who's a very popular man in Illinois, Douglas, again and again, derides Lincoln as a black Republican, again and again tries to smear him as a friend of Frederick Douglass. And in that rain of insults, in that shameless effort by Douglass to play the race card, I think he used the expression black Republicanism 11 times in that one debate, Lincoln holds his ground and says, you know, I might not be I'm no special friend of the Negro, but I think a man who works honestly at his labor deserves an honest wage. And that was a revolutionary thing to say about freedom and slavery at that point. So.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your book. I've been following y'all around as y'all have been developing this.
I'm sorry, did you say you were stalking us?
Yeah. Well, stalking Philadelphia, black Philadelphia, because black Philadelphia is stalking black Philadelphia, because as you made reference, and I heard you on HYY, and you were making the same reference, of how this is a history. Here's a people in a city, and as you polled today, where a lot of people don't know about the history of the people that they will call themselves Philadelphians. All of us will call ourselves Philadelphians, but we don't know about a major component that makes up Philadelphia. Speculative question. If this continues, what's the ramifications for that for black Philadelphians who have been having this history kind of told to them or absent from them? In the future, as we deal with this, as you say, the social, I think I heard Mr. Smith, the condition that exists, because if we keep saying we don't know, then we act like these things are new and just discovered.
Yeah,
so that's a speculative
This point. Isn't just a problem for black residents of Philadelphia. This civil rights movement that Dan and I wrote about was in Cincinnati and Detroit and Boston and New York and Harrisburg. So it's a story about black America back then. And they weren't writing the history books. So it's these heroic men and women. And, I mean, Dan and I, over and over, as we did the research, kept saying, you know, we could write a book on John Mercer Langston. We could write a book on Henry Highland Garnett. There are a dozen men and women who are just remarkable. And I don't know why someone sort of hasn't done this before. I mean, there is information about all these people in history books. Scholars have looked at them. But somehow it hasn't resonated with anyone. And I'm not smart enough to tell you why that is.
And I think in recent years, maybe in the last 15, 20 years, I mean, we're really neophytes as scholars. There's some real historians in this audience, such as the great Phil Absansky sitting right in front of you, who know this stuff and have written beautifully about it. The fact that it's not widely taught in schools in Philadelphia, I think, is a crime and a tragedy. I mean, as Murray says, the stories we came across of, you know, even if you took away the political side and just focused on the black intelligentsia of the mid-19th century, again, I was a history major. I never realized that there was a literary, artistic, poetry writing intelligentsia that had allies across the ocean, you know, had contacts in France and Britain and the Caribbean, you know, to where, I mean, one of our favorite scenes in the book, Frederick Douglass could tour Scotland and Ireland and England in the 1840s, and he was already so well known and admired there that he was like a rock star. Our editor, Micah Clyte, God bless him, talked us out of using the phrase rock star in this book about the 19th century. But I mean, a truly spectacular thing that really, you know, in my opinion, ought to be taught in every damn Philadelphia high school, white, black, private, public, parochial, charter, is the story of these men and women, black and white, who fought these battles against enormous peril and you know, not only like the modern civil rights movement, encountered perils and got injured and bloodied and had their bones broken, and then miraculously decided to go back for more. Men and women ran south. That was a discovery for me. We've all heard great stories of the Underground Railroad, of whole families that ran north and made it all the way to Canada. I'd never known before that many of those same men and women turned back south because they had loved ones in the south, and they knew that they were likely to be tortured or killed or at the very least re-enslaved if they were caught in the South. Nonetheless, they had the courage to run back into the American South in those days to try to rescue those loved ones. I mean, those are stories that a kid should not graduate from high school in this city without knowing. And, I mean, it's great. You know, it's not just a black book. We were bowled over at some of the white stories, too. Some of the white allies of this movement, Miller McKim, this great militant Underground Railroad guy, William Kelly, a congressman who had grown up with black kids and just by nature adopted black allies, gave the first white political speech to a black audience. And above all, little Lucretia Mott, sickly her whole life, bent at the waist, but by 1850 and 60, she was like the Mother Teresa of the abolition movement, and you couldn't face her down. I mean, kids should know this story. You know, Lucretia Mott in 1863 or 4, at the height of the war, at the height of, well, actually at the beginning of the movement to integrate the streetcars, by then, you know, she was a known face in Philadelphia. And for the last 30 or 40 years of her life, she had come up with a tactic, and I wonder to this day where she learned it or did she just come up with it, that she knew something other people didn't and had the courage to do something that other well-off whites, and she was quite well-off, did not do, and that was walk with and sit with people of color. And that made an enormous political statement. 1863, the war is at its height. Black men are being trained at Camp William Penn up in Cheltenham. One day, Mott is riding a streetcar on that line because her family has a great big farm up there, and an old woman of color is being made to stand out on the platform in the rain because it's a whites-only car. It's November, right? It's cold, it's rainy. And Lucretia Mott, this international celebrity by then, says to the conductor, you know, you need to let her inside the car. And the conductor refuses and throws the N-word at her and says, you know, it's not me, it's the company rule, the eternal excuse. Mott asks him again, and he refuses again and says, well, if she's going to stand out there in the rain, then I'll have to stand out there with her. And the conductor hems and haws and curses and waves them both inside. Now, that to me is a great example of modern style witness. And, you know, that's a good story that could be taught in a school, too.
Someone in the back. Young woman in the hat?
Young woman without the hat.
Oh.
Thanks so much for your book. I'm always really interested to think about the 1860s.
Put the microphone up closer. I can't hear you.
I'm always interested to think about the 1860s because...
Me too.
Yeah, I mean, because they sort of pays it forward to the 1960s. I feel like there's like a direct line or something into 2010 as well. But I was wondering how Philadelphians stack up as abolitionists in terms of creativity and sort of... body English and all sorts
of
characteristics.
You mean in those days?
Yeah.
You got to read Chapter 9 in particular.
You're good.
There's great
focus.
Really, there's wonderful accounts from those days of how the white abolitionists here were brave and not so brave from time to time. I mean, Lucretia Mott has no equal. I mean, she was a woman 150 years ahead of her time. I mean, a white man doing what she did would have been outrageous and unheard of. A woman doing it was practically criminal.
Yeah,
there's other Quaker abolitionists who were not quite so strong.
Yeah, let me add one point. While one could say that Philadelphia was a center of white abolition back then, it was not a center of white efforts to get civil rights for blacks. There are not very many white supporters of giving blacks full rights. Lucretia Mott is an exception, not the rule. And I don't know that there's any city, quite frankly, in the North that is a city we should be proud of.
I mean, Boston had some great militant abolitionists,
yes,
like William Lloyd Garrison.
Yes.
But when he started out and was given his great early anti-slavery speeches in the 1830s, his fellow Bostonians tied a rope around him and dragged him through the streets and nearly killed him.
Yeah. Someone else. Yes, ma'am.
Oh. Can I just say we have time for one more question?
Really?
Maybe two. Let's
two.
Say two.
Maybe two.
Okay.
These
are wonderful people. Okay.
Let's take a vote.
Wait, Leonard. Leonard has to leave everyone. So, Leonard,
yeah.
Yes. Yes.
I wanted to comment on the gentleman's question about did it change your opinion on Abraham Lincoln? Because thing is expand your knowledge of history. I myself have become a product of the school systems in America and didn't know the other associated information that Murray and Dan are sharing. So the book is really not an indictment of a person, but just expands your information about what was happening politically, daily, in the country at that particular time. So that was my impression of it. So it didn't change my impression of Abraham Lincoln. It gave me more of an understanding of what was going on around Octavius Cato, what was going on around Abraham Lincoln, things that we didn't learn in the school system and still are not part of the school system now. That's what makes this book such an important book.
Okay, young lady right here who's been very patient. There's a lot of pressure, and it's the last question.
You may not like what I'm going to say.
Go right ahead.
But now that you have all this information,
yes.
When are you going to write your next book?
My job at the moment is to sell this one. And if it's successful, if enough people buy the book, who knows, perhaps there will be another, because there's certainly a great deal of information more to mine. But that's a very nice question, and I still like you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Did you take my glass case?
Yeah. Okay, maybe I did. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's good. Yeah, I went back.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.